is the Brant County Study Day. Our speakers are Brother Stephen Hornhart from Salisbury, Adelaide, Australia. The main theme for our day, Showing the Way, Samuel and the People. This is class number 2, and the subject for this class is The Glory is Departed from Israel.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters and young people, to our second study this morning. Well, we've just read through the 1 Samuel chapter 4, and there is no doubt that as we read through this chapter, the issues are absolutely crystal clear. Shiloh has got to go. The current priesthood has got to go. The ark has got to go. Because brothers and sisters and young people, Israel had shown itself no different to a Gentile nation that had been steeped in their own idolatry. And you will know that for the next 3 chapters, there is no prayer. Israel should have prayed when they lost 4,000 men. No prayer. Eli should have prayed when the ark was marched out of Shiloh, taken out of the holiest of holies, marched out by his 2 boys. His heart trembled after the ark. Eli should have prayed. No prayer. Phinehas's wife at the end of this chapter should have prayed as she cried out in pain and labour. No prayer. In chapter 5, the Philistines should have prayed as their gods were toppled and as tumours broke out all over their bodies and as their fields through the rats and the mice turned to a dust bowl. No prayer. The men of Beth-Shemesh, who were out there just reaping out there in the lovely sunny day, which is what we'd like to see in Canada every now and then, out there in Beth-Shemesh, brothers and sisters, and they're reaping their wheat, and all of a sudden the ark pops up unannounced, unexpected. No prayer. In fact, the men of Beth-Shemesh could not wait to get rid of the ark, just like the Philistines when it came upon them. All the way through these 3 chapters, brothers and sisters, there is no prayer because there is no Samuel. He was the man marked out with prayer. And Israel did not know where God was. Now, this morning in our second study, we want to talk about where God really is. We want to talk about commitment. We want to talk about, brothers and sisters and young people, how easy it is to allow externals in our worship to get in the way of our personal relationship with God. So easy in this age, so easy in this generation, to allow externals to get in the way of our personal, intimate, real relationship with God. You know, a number of years ago, a brother handed me an article, and the article was called The Activity Trap. And the article went on to explain in these large corporate organisations where they had mission statements, they had goals, and therefore they set in place all of these policies and procedures to allow their employees to reach the goal that was set, the bureaucracy, the red tape. And what the article went on to say was that with religious organisations, they are particularly vulnerable to this activity trap. And the article went on to say and show a little example where a child got up in the middle of the night to go to the bathroom. And when the child returned, his bed was made. So the mother had gotten so used to making the bed. Beds were to be made, not slept in, or made untidy. The activity trap. And we've got to be oh so careful, brothers and sisters. That can happen to us. That happened to Israel. Look, study days are fantastic, so needful. Youth group activities are absolutely critical and needful. Bible classes, absolutely important. But they're a means to an end. Don't let them become the end in themselves. See them as being designed to make us more godly and to move us toward the kingdom of God. Let's not see the activities as the end in themselves. And the tragedy of this fourth chapter is that it serves to highlight to you and me just how morally degenerate and how weak God's people had become. And 40 years of Eli's feeble leadership had not helped one bit. And the Philistines are going to capitalise on this. They're going to take advantage of a nation that was besieged with internal jealousy and lust. And God is going to make no move to attempt to free this people from their enemies until a pure national religion was restored, until men and women were committed to God, not a piece of furniture, not a lucky charm, to God, brothers and sisters. And therefore, we read in 1 Samuel and chapter 4 and verse 1 these words. And the word of Samuel came unto all Israel. Now Israel went out against the Philistines to battle and pitched beside Ebenezer, and the Philistines pitched at Aphek. Now, brothers and sisters, the first sentence in this verse, this first verse of chapter 4, the first sentence actually belongs to the end of chapter 3. So what you do is you read verse 21 of chapter 3, these words. And Yahweh appeared again in Shiloh. For Yahweh revealed himself to Samuel in Shiloh by the word of Yahweh, and the word of Samuel came to all Israel. That's how you would read the end of chapter 3. So God would speak to Samuel, and in turn, Samuel would convey the word to the nation. Now you take away this sentence, you take away that first sentence out of chapter 4, and it still appears that Israel initiated the fight. There's no suggestion as to why Israel will even attempt to do this. I don't think they did, brothers and sisters. I don't think Israel initiated the fight at all. In fact, you come back, for instance, on the contrary, you come back to Joshua chapter 15. I don't think Israel were going out there puffing their chests out and saying, right, we're going to take on the Philistines. No, they reacted. When you come to chapter 15 of Judges, I beg your pardon, not Joshua, Judges chapter 15, we read these words. Do you reckon Israel initiated the fight? Well, verse 9, Judges 15. And the Philistines went up and pitched in Judah and spread themselves in Lehi. And the men of Judah said, why? What are you doing here? Why have you come up? And they said, well, we've come up to bind Samson and to do to him what he's done to us. Well, then 3,000 men of Judah went up to the top of the rock Etam and said to Samson, what are you doing? Samson, what are you doing? You're stirring up the Philistines. So they're remonstrating with Samson. Leave us in peace, they're saying to Samson. Don't stir them up. They're our rulers. Let sleeping dogs lie. So I don't think, therefore, brothers and sisters, that they were initiators of the fight. However, we come in to 1 Samuel chapter 4, and now we've got the Philistine army, and they are encamped at Aphek. And you can see on the map there, you may be able to see that Aphek is about 30 kilometres north of the highest of the Philistine towns, Ekron. So about 30 k's north there, northeast-ish, is the place of Aphek. Aphek's about level, well, not quite, but about level, another 28 or so kilometres is Shiloh over here. So if you're there in Aphek and you're looking up to the hills in the eastern direction, you see Shiloh. And if you're in Shiloh looking down the plain in the westerly direction, you are looking at Aphek. There they are, brothers and sisters. In the west, in the foothills, are the Philistines. And this is a clear demonstration that the Philistines could move freely up and down the land with impunity. They're 30 kilometres north of their most northern place. And their presence, the presence of the Philistines, was intimidating, and it was a threat to the tabernacle at Shiloh. Therefore, in the Septuagint, you read these words as chapter 4 begins, taking out that sentence and popping that first sentence up there in chapter 3. So you read in the Septuagint, and it came to pass in those days that the Philistines gathered themselves together against Israel to war. And Israel went out to meet them and encamped at Ebenezer, and the Philistines encamped at Aphek. Brothers and sisters, out go the Israelites with the objective to protect their sanctuary. And I tell you this, you cannot protect the sanctuary of God if your heart is not right. And you can't go to war with the enemy if you don't know where you are. And Israel had no idea where they were. Philistines did. Record there says, now Israel pitched beside Ebenezer, and the Philistines pitched at Aphek. Now, brothers and sisters, Israel are now camping at a place that would not be named Ebenezer. It would not be named by Samuel until another 20 years hence. So here is Israel in chapter 7 of 1 Samuel. Ebenezer is named the Stone of Help. It hasn't got a name. There's the Philistines in a name. They knew the name of where they pitched. It had a meaning, and they were going to make that meaning real in their life. But Israel had no idea. They pitched at a place that had zero meaning. And the ignorance, brothers and sisters, of the place where they pitched as they're trying to protect the sanctuary, as they're trying to go to war with the enemy, the ignorance of the meaning of this place was prophesied 450 years before. Deuteronomy chapter 32. Zero meaning as they went out to face the army of the Philistines. Deuteronomy 32. Verse 18. There they are at Ebenezer. No name. It does mean Stone of Help, but that wouldn't be named for 20 years later. Here they are, verse 18. Deuteronomy 32. Of the rock that begat thee, the rock, the Stone of Help, no rock here as they go up to face of it. No Stone of Help here. Of the rock that begat thee, thou art unmindful and hast forgotten the God that formed thee. Do you know, brothers and sisters and young people, the Hebrew word for forgotten means to mislay. It means to mislay. They didn't know where God was. They couldn't find, but they thought God was in a box, in a golden box. Where is he? Oh, I don't know. Maybe he's in the chest. I don't know. They did not know where God was. They didn't know where he was. They thought he was in this golden box. And who was there, brothers and sisters? Who was there in Israel to teach them any different? You turn the page. Verse 28 of Deuteronomy 32. Didn't know where God was. Pitched at a place that had zero meaning to them. Well, verse 28. For they are a nation void of counsel. Neither is there any understanding in them. Oh, that they were wise. Oh, that they understood this, that they would consider their latter end. How should one chase 1,000 and two put 10,000 to flight, except their rock had sold them and Yahweh had shut them up. Brothers and sisters, the Philistines would never, ever have routed Israel if God had not sold them. But he did. And in the end, it was the enemy who acknowledged that their God, the gods of the Philistines, were no match for Israel's rock. And they sent the ark back to the Philistines, humbled, and Dagon flat on his face. Therefore, verse 31, for their rock is not as our rock, even our enemies. Themselves are a judge to that fact. Look at the ark. Get rid of the ark. It went from this place to that place. We get rid of it. There's mice and rats all over it. We've got boils and tumours. We've got the bubonic plague everywhere throughout the land. Get rid of it. Even our enemies acknowledge that our rock is... But Israel, brothers, oh, zero. Zero meaning. Didn't know where they were because they had not been taught. There were no leaders in the nation to teach them any otherwise. Oh, Philistines, Different story altogether, brothers. Different. They encamped at Aphek. And Aphek means restrained. It comes from the idea in the Hebrew of strength through abstinence. So to the Philistines, the place where they camped meant discipline, brothers and sisters. Discipline. It meant discipline in war. It also has the meaning of fortress. You hear the Philistines, we are at a fortress. And then they took the ark to Ashdod, Ravager. And then God caused little fortresses to pop out all over their bodies, because that's the meaning of the word tumour. Fortresses popped out. Oh, I'll teach you fortress, God said. But here they are. That's later. Here they are. Here are the Philistines. And they're encamped at a place which means strength through abstinence. They weren't confused. They weren't ignorant as to the place where they camped. And they were determined, brothers and sisters and young people, the Philistines were determined to make Aphek real in their life. Look at verse 2 of 1 Samuel 4. They were determined to make Aphek real. We read these words, verse 2. And the Philistines put themselves in array against Israel. And when they joined battle, Israel was smitten before the Philistines, and they slew of the army in the field about 4,000 men. Now that statement there that says in verse 2, the Philistines put themselves in array against Israel, that statement springs directly from the word Aphek. All right? They pitched in Aphek. Strength through abstinence. And immediately after that word Aphek, the Philistines put themselves in array. The word array in the Hebrew means to set in a row. It means to set in order. It wasn't both armies that did that. It was only the Philistines. Discipline. Discipline. This is the idea of strength through abstinence and discipline. So here's the Philistine. All right, you go over there. You move that right in that line. You check that, got that, plug that up. On. They're all setting up. They're disciplined. And over there's a rabble, brothers and sisters. Rabble. Israel, didn't know where they were. No discipline there. So there they are. And the belief in a cause was very evident with the Philistines, because only one side had this setting in a row or setting in an order. And therefore, when the battle was joined, the Hebrew is spread. When the battle was spread, Israel was pushed and pushed until 4,000 men perished. Do you know Jesus said in Luke chapter 16 and verse 8 that the children of this world are more wise in their generation than the children of light? And here were the Philistines, brothers and sisters. They knew exactly what they wanted. They knew exactly what they wanted to take. If we live in this world without knowing where God is and without understanding the meaning of the place where we pitch our tent and we want to go to war with the flesh, we will fail every time. We'll be overrun by an army who knows exactly what they're about. People in the world know what they want and how to get it, and they will tread, push, elbow, anyhow and any which way to get what they want. Why don't we have the same tenacity as far as God is concerned and the Word of God? They will stop at nothing if they've got a cause. We'll be overrun if we don't know where we are, brothers and sisters. Well, the elders of Israel, why have we lost? What's happened to us? We just lost 4,000. Why? What's God doing? Why have we lost? The elders cried in verse 3. Well, that's a good question. Here's some better ones. Why are worshippers at Shiloh turning up drunk? Why? Why are women being seduced at the door of the tent? Why is corruption and violence tolerated in the meeting? And why are we out there trying to protect brutality and lust, which is what Shiloh was all about in the tabernacle? Why are you protecting brutality? Hophni, the clenched fist, and lust. Phinehas, the mouth of brass. Why? Well, the answer, brothers and sisters, was leadership. or the lack thereof. And now, instead of calling the people together after they'd lost 4,000 men, instead of rallying the ecclesia together and resolving in prayer, they start to quarrel with God. They're not happy with what God's done. And they're disputing the matter with God boldly. It wasn't that Israel had sinned, brothers and sisters. They weren't willing to see it, nor own it. Never mind what we've been up to. What's God doing this to us? And it really is summed up. The attitude of verse 3 of Israel is summed up in Proverbs 19 and verse 3. And this, I'll read it to you. We won't turn it up. But Proverbs 19 verse 3. A man's folly ruins his life, yet his heart rages against Yahweh. Your folly got you here, and your heart is raging against Yahweh. And so, brothers and sisters and young people, here they are, they've just lost 4,000 men. They thought they could just go out there, be invincible, trying to protect brutality and lust, trying to protect that people are being seduced at the tent of the meeting. They're out there, and Israel, they're all confused. Some of them are afraid. Some of them are angry. And all of them are ignorant. And then someone pipes up and says, I know what the problem is. I got it. I've just worked it. I know why we've just been beaten. I know why we've lost 4,000 men. I know what the problem is. What is it? I know. What is it? Tell us. God's not here. Pardon? No, he's not here. We left God back. God's 30 kilometres away. We've left him back there. That is stupid. That is ridiculous. But brothers and sisters, how many times do we live like we believe God is back in the ecclesial hall? We leave the meeting, we shake hands, we smile, open up our Bibles, quite a few little quotes, go back home and talk badly to our wife or our husband. Or we go to the meeting, spiritually uplifted, we come out and we go to a place in the afternoon that we would feel uncomfortable to take Jesus Christ. Or we go to the meeting and we pop in a DVD or whatever and we watch something that we would feel very uncomfortable to have Jesus Christ sit next to us. How many times do we leave God back 30 kilometres away? Eh? They thought like that, brothers and sisters, because life was all about them. You read of that in verse 3. Listen to the humanism scream out from verse 3. And when the people were come into the camp, the elders of Israel said, Why? Why has Yahweh smitten us today before the Philistines? Let us fetch the ark of the covenant of Yahweh out of Shiloh unto us, that when it cometh among us, it may save us out of the hand of our enemies. There they are, brothers and sisters. Were this people so special? Were this people so privileged that they could call God out of his place and demand he come to them? You know, there's a lesson here, brothers and sisters. It's a common thing for those who have removed themselves from the imperatives of religion to discover a great fondness for ritual and external observation. It is a common thing for those who have removed themselves from the imperatives of religion to discover a fondness of ritual and external observation. They had lost their reverence for God. They presumed upon his grace. How many brethren and sisters turn up at the memorial meeting, and sometimes, sadly, that's the only meeting they come to? I know there is health problems. I'm not saying that at all. But by choice, sadly, how many turn up at the memorial meeting and that's the only meeting? Sunday morning, Christadelphians. I used to go to church years ago, and that's what you did. You went to church on Sunday morning. That was it. You just said a few things, got a bit clean. You went out and you lived your life the way you want to live. You go back again 1 hour. 1 hour? A week? No way, brothers and sisters. No way. But how many turn up at the memorial meeting and think that somehow, in some magical way, when Christ returns, we'll be saved? It does not work that way. Israel had a fiery zeal for the ark, but they treated its substance with contempt. They made an idol of the ark. Do you know the Philistines used to go into battle and they used to take little idols with them? So before we go to battle, we better make sure. Oh, I've got a little idol there. I'll pop that in that pocket. That'll be helpful. Oh, there's another one. Oh, I could use you, little fella. Yeah, pop you over there. Oh, there's another one. Yep. So I've got idols all in their pockets. And Israel knew that. Israel knew that these Philistines are out there with little idols in their pockets, you see. So Israel says, we'll beat them with a bigger idol. We'll get the ark. Oh, brothers and sisters, awful, awful superstition that Israel had plummeted into. And they called it in verse 4. So the people sent to Shiloh that they might bring from thence, listen to this, the ark of the covenant of Yahweh of armies, which dwelleth between the cherubim. Hear what they say? How could God not save the covenant people? How could God's army, the ark of the covenant of Yahweh of armies, how could his army not be there but to save us? And would God allow an uncircumcised nation to dislodge him from between the cherubim? They thought, brothers and sisters, they'd connected all the dots, but they just didn't get it. And when the ark arrived, brothers and sisters, when the ark arrived, the camp erupted, and there on either side of the ark was the clenched fist, Hophni, and Phinehas, the mouth of brass. On either side, carrying this ark. And they're saying, the ark of the covenant? These men disgraced the covenant, brothers and sisters. What hypocrisy. And they had the temerity to believe they were walking the same road as Moses. Oh, they could have quoted Numbers 10:35. Oh, look at arise, O Yahweh, and go before us and scatter our enemies. They could have said, oh, well, Moses did it. We can do the same. You know, we need to understand, just as you pick this record up, we need to understand the time frame here, brothers and sisters, to better understand and appreciate the reaction of the Philistines when the ark turns up. Now, to get this ark, we've got to go and get it. We've got to go and get God. He's 30 kilometres away. We've got to go and get him. To get the ark, it's a two-day process. Right? You've got to send the runner up. You've got to go uphill. A day to get there. So 30 kilometres is a runner. You haven't got your big cars you have in Canada. He's not flying. He didn't go to the airport. He's running. So you've got this fellow running uphill a day. Gets there. We need the box. We need the ark. We need to get it out of the... And it took another day to come downhill as they are carrying the ark. And for 2 days, the Philistines waited. Now, could you imagine? Israel, just over the way there. Where's the river? Is the river close here? How far is the river away? Is the river here, near? Just over there, is it? Very far away?
About 400 yards.
Yeah, okay. So there's Israel. Israel just over there, just by the river. 400 yards? 400 metres, I get that, I understand the conversion. So there's Israel. There's Israel, brothers and sisters. They're all over there and they're in camp over just by the river. And we're the Philistines and we're in the camp, right? 2 days. The runner's gone and the ark's tracking its way down. 2 days. They're waiting and there's not a peep. There's not a boom coming from the other camp in Israel. It's all quiet. You can imagine the young fellas in the Philistine camp saying to their leaders, to their captains, we're gonna get them. We're gonna finish them off. I've already got 4,000 notched up on our guns. Can we go and finish the rest of them off? And you can hear the old fellas saying to the young Philistines, look, just let them stew in their own fear. Can you hear anything? Nah. Can you hear them rattling their teapots and their cotton? Nah. They're insomniac. They're not sleeping, I'll tell you. They're not sleeping over there. Leave them stew in their fear. And they're waiting. And it's all quiet. A day goes by. Not a rattle of a spoon in a bowl over there. No one's sleeping. They're just wait. Psychological warfare. It was a good technique. That was a good strategy, brothers and sisters. And then, after all that silence, verse 5, 1 Samuel 4. After all that, 1 Samuel 4, verse 5. And when the Ark of the Covenant of Yahweh came into the camp, all Israel shouted with a great shout, so the earth rang again. Again. NIV, all Israel raised such a great shout, the ground shook. And the word great there in the Hebrew means to split the ears. And these two armies are so close to each other, brothers and sisters, that the Philistines heard and felt the tremor. This is like Jericho, all because the earth rang again. as it did way back there in Jericho, when they marched around Jericho, not a word, not a peep out of Israel, until at the end of 7 days, and a great shout, and walls fell inward, brothers and sisters, and here's a great shout, and they felt the tremor go through the ground into the Philistine camp. But I tell you this, nothing tipped out of a bowl, no tents were flattened, not like Jericho, nothing moved. And the roar of thousands of people echoing down that valley, sweeping into the Philistine camp. And the Philistines cried out in superstitious dread. Verse 8. Woe unto us. Who shall deliver us out of the hand of these mighty gods? These are the gods that smote the Egyptians with all the plagues that are in the wilderness. Well, brothers and sisters, they failed their history exam. That verse. Their geography was pretty poor too. Give them a D for geography. And their religious studies wasn't tracking too well at all. They thought the plagues were in the wilderness. And they thought that the Egyptians were defeated by the ark. So what have they done? They've taken the plagues and they've popped them in the wilderness. And they've taken the ark and they've popped it in Egypt. They've got it all back to front, have these Philistines. They're superstitious, they're ignorant, and they're uncircumcised. And guess what? So are Israel. They've got it all back to front too. And Israel are superstitious, and Israel are ignorant, and Israel are uncircumcised. And the only difference between the two camps is one of them was disciplined. And that wasn't Israel. Men who knew what they were about and determined to make it happen. Verse 9, 1 Samuel 4, be strong. Be men, O ye Philistines, that ye be not servants unto the Hebrews, as they have been to you. Be men. Now, there's an amazing thing here, brothers and sisters and young people. Paul picks up that battle cry. Why? He picks it up in 1 Corinthians 16. Why? When you go back to 1 Corinthians 16, you come with, he actually plucks it out of Samuel. You come back with me, I'll show you why. It's astounding. Why would Paul's talking to the Corinthians. You look at the context. And he quotes 1 Samuel 4. Well, 1 Corinthians 16. Astounding. Here he is, verse 16, chapter 16, 1 Corinthians, and verse 13. And in your margin says, this is cited from 1 Samuel 4, verse 9. Paul says to the Corinthians, watch ye, stand fast in the faith, be men, be strong. Why does he do that? Well, I think the key is in verse 14. But before we read verse 14, look at verse 15. I beseech you, brethren, you know the house of Stephanos, that it is the first fruits of Achaia, and that they have addicted themselves to the ministry of the saints. Addicted, draw themselves up like soldiers. So Paul says in 1 Corinthians 16, in verse 13, be men. And he says in verse 15, they're soldiers. They've drawn themselves up like soldiers. Why is he doing this? Well, the answer, I think, is verse 14. Paul says, in the smack in the middle of these two kind of soldier bits, he says in verse 14, let all your things be done with love. Strange. Look at verse 22. If any man love not the Lord Jesus Christ. Verse 23. Verse 24, I should say. My love be with you. So love and quoting from these in the Philistines. What is this about? I think the answer, brothers and sisters, is in chapter 13 of 1 Corinthians. Because in chapter 13 of 1 Corinthians, the Corinthians were children in their captivation of the gifts. In 1 Corinthians 13, they were as ignorant of these gifts as Israel were of the ark. They had removed themselves from the vitals of true religion and discovered a great fondness for externals. Now just keep your hand there and just come back to 1 Corinthians 13 and I'll show you why. Look at this. Why quote from the Philistines in the context of Israel who knew not where they were and Israel who were captivated by external, oh, God's in the box. It's an idol. It's a magical thing. It's a talisman. Well, look at chapter 12 of 1 Corinthians. We read this in verse 27. Now you are the body of Christ and members in parts. And God hath set some in the ecclesia, first apostles, secondarily prophets, thirdly teachers, after that miracles, then gifts of healing, helps, governments. Oh, guess what? Tongues is last. Diversity of tongues. Are all apostles? Are all prophets? Are all teachers? Are all workers of miracles? Have all gifts of healing? Do all speak in tongues and interpret? Tongues is last. Now listen to verse 31 as it should read in the Greek. Paul says, captivation, captivation, captivation of external, showy, tongue-speaking gifts. Then Paul says in verse 31, as it should be in the Greek, but you, Corinthians, covet earnestly the showy gifts. And I am going to show you a more excellent way. And then he goes into verse chapter 13. Though I speak with the tongues of men and of angels and have not love, I am become an echo or a child wailing, as it is in the Greek. Tinkling cymbal, a wailing child. Grow up. Be men. Know where you are. Don't be captivated by externals. Verse 2, and though I have the gift of prophecy and understand all mysteries and all knowledge, and though I have all faith so that I could remove mountains and have not love, I am no man, in the Greek. In fact, it's the same word used in chapter 14 and verse 2. Is this word nothing? The word nothing is the same word in verse 2 of chapter 14. For he that speaketh in an unknown tongue speaketh not unto men but unto God. For no man. You see that? No man is the word nothing in verse 2 of chapter 13. And then Paul says in verse 11, when I was a child, and the Greek is no talk. You want to speak in tongues. It's all showy and it's all external. No talk. No talk. When I was no talk, I spake as a no talk, I understood as a no talk, I thought as a no talk, but when I'm a man, I put away the externals, I put away the childish things, and I become a man. Quit ye like men, love. You see? What an astounding thing, brothers and sisters. What an astounding. Set aside your ignorant infatuation for externals and be men, understand the cause and fight for it. And if they'd clung, brothers and sisters, if Israel had clung to the invisible God with all their heart and rejected the visible idolatry, they would have been invincible. But they didn't, and therefore they weren't. So we come back now to 1 Samuel chapter 4. They weren't invincible. They didn't get it right. And therefore, 1 Samuel 4, and we read these words in verse 11 and 12. And the ark of God was taken, and the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, were slain. And there ran a man of Benjamin out of the army and came to Shiloh the same day with his clothes rent and with her. Oh, there's a start. There's a start. There's a man running out of Benjamin. He's got his clothes rent. He's got earth on his head. Well, is it a start? Is this a start to think, oh, we've been going the wrong way. We've got to throw ourselves at God's mercy. We're going to find out from God what he wants. Well, it didn't go very far, this start of this man at Benjamin, because when he does give the report, the ark is last on his list, brothers and sisters. In verse 17, the messenger said, Israel's gone. There's a great slaughter. The two sons of Hophni and Phinehas are dead. Oh, and by the way, the ark is gone. So the ark was last on his list. So it's not a real good turnaround, is it? Having clothes rent and having earth upon his head. You notice, brothers and sisters and young people, that the two very important words here in 1 Samuel 4 and verse 12 is the word Benjamin and the word Shiloh. You know the last reference to Benjamin before this event was the last chapter of Judges. And in Judges, in chapter 21, the last chapter, we know it ends. In those days, there was no king in Israel. Every man did that which was right in his own eyes. Have a look in the last record to Benjamin before we pick this Benjamite up here. Haven't mentioned Benjamin until now. That's the last record. And there it is, intertwined with Shiloh. So there's Benjamin and there's Shiloh. There's Benjamin and there's Shiloh. And this man runs out And he brings this report, brothers and sisters. Now, we know the situation that happened with the incidences in Judges 21. Just a very, very quick. I'm watching the time. I'm very aware of the time. I'm very aware that you shouldn't be hungry for lunch, should you? Because you had a very, very big morning tea. So we won't let you go to lunch early. 1 Samuel 21, brothers and sisters. You know the story. Sorry, beg your pardon. Judges chapter 21. Last chapter. Last time Benjamin is mentioned in the context of Shiloh. Verse 1. Now the men of Israel had sworn in Mizpah, saying, "There shall not any of us give his daughter unto Benjamin to wife." That was awful, wasn't it? Awful what the Benjamites had done. Awful about the Levites' concubine. It was awful, brothers and sisters. And this little tribe was going to be wiped out. Verse 6. The children of Israel repented for them because of Benjamin. They thought, "We've given them some wives. We've given them 400 wives from the men of Jabesh Gilead, but that's not enough. We're going to try and find some more wives for them." They were angry with Benjamin for what they'd done, and they went and had a great war upon them. Then they tried to get 400 wives to make sure the tribe didn't go out of existence. Not enough, the 400 wives. And they say, "I know what we'll do. We'll go to the feast of God." Look at verse 19. And they said, "Behold, there's a feast of Yahweh in Shiloh, yearly in a place which is on the north side of Bethel, on the east side of the highway that goeth up from Bethel to Shechem, on the south of Labonai. We'll go to the feast, and then the Benjamites, they can hide in the bushes, and when the maidens come out to dance, they can run out of the bushes and grab whatever maiden they want." That's awful! They're going to go and have a party, and they're going to hide in bushes and go out and grab wives and drag them off. Now, we know that story, but look at Israel's ignorance, brothers and sisters. Oh, there's a combined fraternal. It's in Shiloh. Do you know where it is? Nah. I better give you some instructions. Look, you haven't been there? Nah, not for a while. Oh, okay. Well, I'll tell you. It's on the east side of the highway that goeth up from Bethel. Not enough instructions. Oh, well, okay, you're going to Shechem, and it's on the south of Labonah. They had to give them GPS signals, brothers and sisters, to show them which way to go to the combined fraternal. That's how ignorant they were of the things that were going on in Shiloh. And when they did get there, it was a big party, jumping out of bushes through lust and taking away those women. What a terrible thing. Now here's a man running out of Benjamin, running back to Shiloh, brothers and sisters. And for this Benjamite in Shiloh, unlike the last time the Benjamites were in Shiloh, and for this time, there's no laughter, there's no lust. It's rent clothes and head covered with earth. And he's fled. And everyone else had fled to his tent in verse 10. And they took their own report back to that place. You know, brothers and sisters, there was no place in all Israel more concerned about the ark than Shiloh. And well they might be, because all the city cried out. The ark would never return to that place again. And the Philistines are about to press their advantage. The Philistines, brothers and sisters, are about to press it. They've routed Israel there. They're only about 30 k's from Shiloh. Did the Philistines push and push and eventually take Shiloh? We know, we're not told anything in Samuel that the Philistines pressed on to Shiloh. But 450 years later, in Jeremiah's time, the outcome of Shiloh had become a byword. Now, we won't turn this up. If you're taking notes, Jeremiah 7, verse 12 and verse 14. The Babylonians are coming down. And God says, "You remember what I did in Shiloh." The Babylonians are coming in Jeremiah 7 and verse 12 and 14. "Remember what I did in Shiloh. You get your house in order because the Babylonians are coming." Now, in Psalm 78, again, we won't turn that up, time's the enemy. But in Psalm 78 and verse 60 through to verse 64, we read these words, and I'll read them to you. Did the Philistines go to Shiloh? Well, in Psalm 78, verse 60 through 64, this is what it says in verse 63. "The fire decimated the army, leaving the young women without potential husbands." That's what it says in the Psalm. In verse 64, it says, "The priests fell by the sword and their widows made no lamentation." Ah, so Jeremiah and the Psalm, Psalm 78, indicates strongly that the Philistines had come down and they'd burnt and they'd ransacked Shiloh, brothers and sisters. Now, you've got to put yourself in the picture here, you see. Archaeological support for this very thing is very, very clear. It's generally accepted that the Battle of Aphek, here in chapter 4 of Samuel, took place approximately 1050 BC. So 1,050 years before Christ, the Battle of Aphek took place. And there's archaeological evidence that strongly indicates that Shiloh was decimated by fire in the middle of the 11th century BC. So it seems that the Philistines turned from the routing of Israel at Aphek, and now they got their mark on Shiloh. They're 30 kilometres away, brothers and sisters. Now look, we get a record in Samuel about Eli's mind. We're given a script of the involvement in 1 Samuel 4 of Eli's two sons. We're even given a summary statement of Phinehas' wife and her response to the disaster. Where's Samuel? Where's Samuel while all this is going on? What's he thinking? What's Samuel doing? He can't be old enough to have had a direct influence, or his cry would have been heard, brothers. I reckon Samuel's about 15 through 17 years of age while this is going on. Who's there left to take charge in the tabernacle? The Philistines have got the ark. They're on the move. They're coming to get the rest. They're going to come and get the lampstand, the table of showbread. They're coming to get the altar of burnt offering. They're coming to get the lot. Who's in charge? Who's there to get the furniture out of the temple and get it divvied up all around the land so the Philistines don't have one centre to get it? Who's going to take control? Who's going to pull it all together? Doesn't need a lot of imagination, brothers and sisters, to see a teenager, young men, falling on his knees in prayer, then directing the events in a way that would mark him out as a man of clear decision in times of crisis. And so they all cried out in verse 14 through 15 in 1 Samuel chapter 4. They cried out in verse 14 and 15. And when Eli heard the noise of the crying, he said, what's the noise? What's the tumult? And the man that come running past him told Eli. Now Eli was 98 years old and his eyes were dim so that he could not see. Two different Hebrew words. In chapter 3, verse 2, his eyes waxed dim. Hebrew, feeble or obscure. Here in chapter 4, verse 15, note your margin, his eyes stood. They were fixed. Or they were set. His eyes were set so he could not see. Rotherham says his eyes were fixed so he could not see. Brothers and sisters, Eli was totally and absolutely blind. The only thing that stood was not the man, never stood, just sat. The only thing that stood was his eyes, and that was in a bad sense. And the presence of God had departed, and with it went the old man's eyes and his life. Verse 18, and it came to pass when he made mention of the ark of God that he fell from off the seat backward by the side of the gate, and his neck brake and he died, for he was an old man and he was heavy. You tell that story once to Sunday school students, a story never to be forgotten. He fell back and broke his neck, bloodless sacrifice, bloodless. That's the sacrifice was offered for the unredeemed, brothers and sisters. But the conclusion of the chapter doesn't leave us with the picture of Eli falling back and breaking his neck. As significant as that was, that does not take centre stage. What takes centre stage, brothers and sisters, is Eli's daughter-in-law, and that leaves you and me with a greater impression. Verse 19 and 21. And his daughter-in-law, Phinehas' wife, was with child, near to be delivered, and when she heard the tidings that the ark of God was taken and that her father-in-law, her husband, were dead, she bowed herself and travailed, for her pains came upon her. And about the time of her death, the women that stood by her said, you're going to have a child, I don't want him. But you're going to give birth to a little baby, I don't want a baby. But this is a new life, I don't want new life. And she turns up, could you imagine that? She turns up, I don't want this child. There is no glory. What a sad thing. What glory would there be for his older brother? This child coming to the world and the mother doesn't want anything to do with it. Very different to Hannah. This woman has a child, brothers and sisters, and this little Ichabod was the younger brother of Ahitub. And Ahitub, possibly 3 years old, is going to be the next high priest. Where's the glory for him? Where's the glory for her dead husband? Where's the glory for the dead high priest? Where's the glory for Israel? God's name and God's purpose had been profaned by heathen men, and all because Israel did not know where God was, brothers and sisters. Can you see Samuel? Did Samuel take Ichabod in his arms and take him up to Hannah? Did Samuel take a three-year-old, a Ahitub, three-year-old, and take him up to his mum? We don't know. But poetic license would like me to think that maybe a little three-year-old was returned to Hannah. You've got to think, brothers and sisters, where's Samuel? And here was this woman, there is no glory. And it was, brothers and sisters, all because of Israel, did not know where God was. Of the rock that begat them, thou art unmindful, and they mislaid God that had formed them. Well, God willing, brothers and sisters, in our next study, we'll finish our studies together on a very lovely high note with Israel, and our subject will be, God willing, in chapter 7 of 1 Samuel, repentance at Ebenezer. Thank you.